Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Hi, Beth Ann.
Hello there, Chris.
I remember when I was a kid, we used to get candy cigarettes, which trained us to yearn for the day when we could smoke cigarettes as being so grown up, right?
There were many kids who were in your position, too, and saw those mint green and pink and blue and yellow candy cigarettes, and some of them, you know, the gum cigarettes, too. And
we couldn't wait.
Yeah, that was just part of adulthood.
That's right.
Being dumbed down for kids' use. And that's part of the problem that we've talked about for a great many years with how the tobacco industry has been marketing to kids.
Yeah.
And it's back at us again. Now, gummy bear, cotton candy, and fruit punch are just a few of the flavors. And unlike relatively benign sweets, these are e-liquid choices. From 2011 to 2015, e-cigarette use among high school students jumped from 1.5% to 16% nationwide. And more kids now use e-cigarettes than traditional varieties. In Hawaii, lawmakers amended the definition of retail tobacco permit in a Senate bill, now with the House, to include the sale of electronic smoking devices and e-liquid. On the eve of a national day to speak out against big tobacco, young people in Hawaii are readying their arguments to take to the state capitol. This year, Kick Butt State is spotlighting how tobacco companies are enticing kids with an ever-growing market of sweet-flavored electronic products. Jessica Yamauchi is the executive director of the Hawaii Pacific Health Institute, which houses the Coalition for Tobacco-Free Hawaii, and she's in our studio now. And it's from, I should say, the Hawaii Public Health Institute.
Thank you.
We've talked many, many times about what has been happening over time with the Master Tobacco Settlement Fund. And just to get us started, what's the status of that right now?
So two years ago, 2015, the legislature did keep intact the Tobacco Trust Fund. They had redistributed certain parts of the Master Settlement Agreement, but the Tobacco Trust Fund remained intact and receives 12.5%. So in years prior to that, we actually were seeing a decline in what was given to the Tobacco Trust Fund based on the economy and funds needing to be diverted elsewhere. So it is good that we are at 12.5%. It is not as high as we would like it to be and not at the levels that CDC would actually recommend is spent on tobacco prevention. And we also want to remind folks that this is from the Master Settlement Agreement, but nothing from the current cigarette tax or the other tobacco product tax that exists goes towards this fund.
And that's the point, because a lot of people erroneously believe that that tax is helping to feed the Master Tobacco Settlement, which sort of leads us back into one of the bills that you have been talking about this time around, SB 404 SD2, now with the House. That would require retailers who engage in the sale of cigarettes, tobacco products, electronic smoking devices, and the e-liquid to fill them to have a retail tobacco permit. In part, that sounds like a way to gather a great deal of data. Do we not have enough data about who's actually selling this stuff?
Yes. So currently there is a tobacco permit that is required for anybody selling tobacco products. However, it does not currently apply to anybody selling electronic smoking devices. So if there's a retailer or a wholesaler who is solely selling electronic smoking devices and no other tobacco permit, they're not required to pull one. And that leaves us with an inaccurate database of all the retailers that are selling, which is problematic because it doesn't allow our Department of Health to properly educate and enforce the current tobacco laws.
The tax that would also be part of this bill, would that, in fact, go back into the Master Tobacco Settlement? Would there be anything coming from it that would help feed that, too?
So that was the intention, is that at least a portion of it would go towards that. And I think the language in the bill was a little problematic. And so it actually got taken out. And we do want to recommend that it go directly into the Tobacco Trust Fund, which does currently exist and could be used for education and enforcement. At least a percentage of these revenues, not necessarily, you know, all of the revenues, but a portion of it. Again, nothing from the cigarette tax or other tobacco product tax currently goes to the Tobacco Trust Fund. As we've been, you know, able to pass some new regulations, it's important to have the resources to really educate and enforce those regulations.
that was supposed to be the other hand with all this. You can't just simply, you know, have tax and regulation without being able to do the education piece, as was originally the idea behind the Master Tobacco Settlement Fund. Part of that education, though, seems to be happening in a social way and with people talking to other people and friends, and you see how many people are standing outside of a party smoking, or when you go into a building, how many people are still there smoking. That number seems to be, in at least anecdotally, decreasing. Looking at this other bill that would prohibit smoking and tobacco use, including electronic devices, on the University of Hawaii campus, that bill was being driven by who? Was students part of that?
Yes, it was part of the governor's package, and there were a total of four bills introduced, and two were part of the governor's package, two were part of the university's package. But, you know, across the country, we've seen many, many, many college campuses and universities have tobacco-free policies in place. And some of the university campuses have done this, but it's not consistent throughout the system. We've also heard from students where they are, especially students here in Hawaii, where they are used to a campus that is completely tobacco-free at their schools in the DOE. And then they go to the university and they're shocked that it's not. So we just, you know, we think that it's important to really have that consistent policy throughout the system.
The focus being on any sort of smoke, not just traditional cigars and cigarettes, but to include what's happening with e-cigarettes too, because that seems to be proliferating. And we talked about some of the stats a little earlier about how much more. That was a nationwide stat. How consistent is that in Hawaii, that 16%?
Our rates are higher here. And I don't have the exact numbers on me right now, but we had just done an interview a couple weeks ago, and I think it was 25% local high school students that had used e-cigarettes in the last 30 days. So it's higher here than it is nationally. And I think one of the things, you know, we're playing catch up. We had very, very progressive laws around tobacco, and e-cigarettes weren't included in most of those laws, and it had been a loophole. And so it grew. I think the use of them really grew. The social norms around them changed. And slowly, we're trying to close these loopholes, and we've made some progress. The tax is one that's a big one, where they're now the only tobacco product that doesn't have a tobacco tax attached to it. So slowly, as we continue to close these loopholes and we continue to do some education, and we'll start to see that social norm change, but it's going to take some time. The industry was way ahead of us on this one.
The kids that you have talked to, and to give it, you know, that incredible statistic of 25% of them who have smoked some sort of e-cigarette in the last 30 days, I mean, that's pretty outstanding given the 16% nationally. But that also seems to say that for quite a while, kids have really understood that this, too, is smoking. It's not just something else in lieu of. That kind of message needs a whole different campaign around it. Are you now strategizing how to target just that, since it's become, in a way, such a monster?
We are. We're looking at all different types of educating that needs to happen. And I think you're exactly right. And we're seeing, you know, the reversal of trends, where our cigarette smoking here among youth is really low. And we continue to see the e-cigarette use climb and climb. We don't have 2016 data yet, so that's from 2015.
So could it be even worse?
It could be. We're going to hope that it might be a little bit better, too. We passed age to 21 law that went into effect January 1, 2016. So, you know, we don't, like I said, we don't have that data yet from 2016. We'll have to see what that looks like. But
when will you have that?
That's a Department of Health question. Sorry.
Okay. All right.
Well, we hope to, you know, like everyone else, the sooner the better. But, yeah.
Well, thank you for coming in. Good luck with these bills. And we should say that although Kit Butts Day is tomorrow nationally, because of spring break and not wanting to haul kids out of school, they, in fact, will be down at the Capitol on Monday. So if you happen to be there, you might just see them there, too.
Thanks
very much, Jessica.
Thank you.
Jessica Yamauchi is the executive director of the Hawaii Public Health Institute. One of its projects is the Coalition for Tobacco-Free Hawaii. The coalition led the effort to raise the age of sale of tobacco products, including e-cigarettes, to age 21. That went into effect last year. Kick Butts Day is tomorrow, and the coalition will be at the state capitol for a rally and walk around to speak with lawmakers about this year's bills on Monday. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, how many sharks are needed for a healthy marine ecosystem? We're going to find out. But first, we'll find out if you know the answer to today's backyard quiz.
Next in the program, we'll be hearing about a long-term study of shark populations. But for today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a popular Garden Isle beach where you can see another large marine animal. The beach in question is one of the best places anywhere to see the rare and endangered Hawaiian monk seal. Its location on the southern coast, far from the rain clouds that frequently hover around Mount Waialeale, keeps the beach dry and sunny, making it a popular destination. A shallow reef on the western side offers excellent snorkeling and the company of green sea turtles. You can also see goatfish, or weke, feeding on the sandy bottom, as well as the Hawaii state fish, the ever-popular humuhumu nuku nuku apua'a, also known as the Hawaiian triggerfish. In the spring, you're also likely to see wedge-tailed shearwaters in large numbers along the coastline. All in all, one of Hawaii's most beautiful spots, and the name alludes to the waves that crash along the shoreline. That's what we're looking for, the name of this popular beach. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer.
Aloha, I'm Carl Meyer from the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Palmyra Atoll is 1,000 miles south of Hawaii, and it's an ideal setting for research into shark populations. Shark sightings are fairly rare in Hawaiian waters, but researchers at Palmyra see them almost every time they get in the water. The Nature Conservancy has just completed an 8-year study of the shark population there, and Eric Conklin, the Conservancy's Director of Marine Science, is on hand to tell us about it. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning.
First of all, these waters down there at Palmyra sound spectacular.
They really are. Superlatives fail, to be honest. It's a place that you really have to see to believe, and I've never met anyone that's had the fortune to go down that hasn't just been completely blown away by the experience.
This is a reef system pretty much untainted by human interference, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. It is, and that's one of the things that makes it so special is it's harder and harder in today's world to find the corners of the globe that are relatively untouched, that have a really light influence of people. And it is one of those places, and we've been incredibly fortunate to be able to work down there and help contribute to conserving that place and keeping it that way.
And this is a marine protected area. What's the designation?
Yeah, it's a preserve for the Nature Conservancy. It's a national wildlife refuge, mm-hmm. and it's also a marine national monument. So it's got several layers of protection, in part because it is such an amazing place and is globally significant in what it has to offer.
And those layers of protection are working, obviously.
That was a big part of why we did the study, actually, is we wanted to verify that that's the case. We believed it to be true, but we thought as part of being good stewards, we needed to make sure we had the right data in place to be able to verify that we were doing a good job of taking care of that place and that those layers of protection were working. And the short version of the answer is it's great and everything is working.
You know, one of the things that's sort of counterintuitive to the layman is the notion that the health of an ecosystem depends on having an appropriate number of apex predators.
Yeah, you know, it's one of the things that's become increasingly clear by studies done all around the world is that the healthiest reefs in the world have very healthy apex predator populations. Mm-hmm. And there's a little bit of a chicken and egg argument. Are they healthy because they have these apex predator populations, or do they have these apex predator populations because they're healthy?
Yeah.
My guess is that it's a combination of both, mm-hmm. that you can only have those populations on a healthy system, but those robust populations of apex predators actually very much do contribute to that system and the maintenance of that system in its state. And so there's that positive feedback of it's not the chicken and egg, it's the cycle of both supporting each other.
Yeah. And if the sharks are getting enough to eat, they're likely to stay around a specific reef system?
Yeah, that was one of the questions that we were looking at is do the reef sharks around Palmyra stay around Palmyra or do they feel the need to leave and migrate to other areas, mm-hmm. where maybe they're not as well protected by the rules and regulations that we have in place in Palmyra. And what we found is the sharks of Palmyra stay at home. Very rarely some will move to neighboring islands and atolls, but the vast majority stay not only around the atoll, but they stay in their particular corner of the atoll and occasionally but rarely even, you know, venture to the other side of the atoll.
If a shark were to traverse from one atoll a reef system to another, wouldn't that involve traveling in an area where there wasn't enough for it to eat?
It absolutely would. It's a bit of a mystery how
do they know where to go?
right. A reef shark leaves Palmyra and has to cross, you know, miles and miles and miles of abyssal ocean and an empty open ocean, and yet they seem to be able to do it upon occasion. But generally speaking, they stay close to home. Although one of the things that actually partners from Stanford found was that many of the reef sharks around Palmyra actually spend a decent amount of their time feeding far offshore. If you look at what their food is, in part coming from the reef itself and in part coming from the open ocean surrounding it, which was a bit of a surprise. Everyone had assumed at that point that most of the food came from the reef itself. The reef is home. The food is from the reef and also from the open ocean next door.
It sort of hints at a pretty sophisticated directional finding system, you know, knowing where they are, knowing where the food is, being able to get far from the reef and know which way is home, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The sensory systems of sharks are a complete marvel that folks have been studying for years and still don't completely understand. Yeah. I think the sharks have a whole suite of sensory systems that allow them to navigate the world that I think are just really difficult for people to even imagine.
Yeah, that gets me to thinking, Eric, you know, what are the, I mean, with a great many creatures like sharks, there's the known and the unknown, to use Dick Cheney's phrase. But, you know, the what is it that's most mysterious, most sort of that is least known about sharks? Where are the areas that we're still a bit baffled?
that's a tough question because what we don't know about sharks vastly outweighs what we do know about sharks.
That's what I thought.
It's really interesting that every person on the globe has some sort of reaction, often a very visceral and perhaps fear-based reaction to the idea of a shark. Everyone knows about them, and yet we know very little about them. So for the vast majority of shark species out there, we don't know, you know, how big they get, how long they live, when they reproduce, how many babies they produce, what kind of habitats they like. Even the ones that are in places that even the ones that are comparatively well studied, it's still what we don't know dwarfs what we do. One of the things that we were particularly interested in with this study is to start to get to the question of how do these sharks interact with their ecosystem. We know they're amazing. We know jumping in the water and being surrounded by sharks is an unforgettable experience.
I bet.
But what's the effect on the system as a whole? Yeah. What are they doing? What are they contributing? What is that cycle of that relationship between healthy sharks and healthy reefs? And what's lost when we lose those?
At first, you thought you were looking at a decline in populations. But what was the, you know, what have you concluded from this 8-year study?
Yeah, that was there were a few different lines of evidence that made us concerned that population levels, shark population levels at Palmyra might be declining, and that was a big part of the impetus for this study. And what we found was that's actually not the case, that the population is substantial. It's roughly 8,344 gray reef sharks at Palmyra. That's a model estimate. It's a very sizable number. It's a very stable population, and it's in good shape. The number wasn't quite as big as some other methods of surveying shark populations had suggested it would be, but it's still considerable. And when you compare it to other areas where people have a much greater impact, it's many, many, many more sharks than you'll find in areas that people have a larger touch.
So if you're lucky enough to be snorkeling in a beautiful reef, thank a shark, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks very much for coming in, Eric.
Thank you.
Eric Conklin is Director of Marine Science at the Nature Conservancy, which has just completed an 8-year study of shark populations at Palmyra Atoll. And you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for today's programming comes from Hawaii Opera Theater, presenting Three Decembers, featuring Frederica von Stada on a 4-island tour, March 24th to April 1st, hawaiioperatheater.org.
Strength in numbers is an old adage finding new meaning as attorneys general across the nation band together to oppose Trump policies. Civil Beat reporter Kirsten Downey has today's reality check. Good morning. Aloha.
Aloha.
Nice to talk to you. Well, you quote in the article up today, Hawaii's AG Douglas Chin is saying that our state's role is, quote, stepping up to fill the gap as the Trump administration cuts back on regulations. Who's joining him?
Well, there's quite a band. You know, in our system of government, there's different checks and balances. We usually think of the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary. But there's also the state versus the federal government. And what we see here is the attorneys general across the country, the Democratic attorneys general, coming together to organize to oppose Republican policies they disagree with.
Though it would seem that with so many issues that are confronting the AGs, that they're going to have to be fairly choosy about which ones they decide to push back. Any sense of what that looks like or in certain sectors?
Well, I think we've definitely seen this very dramatically over the recent travel ban an executive order initially by the Trump administration involving a group of majority Muslim countries. We quickly saw 15 states organize, and Hawaii's been very active on this cause. We actually saw it in another case as well already, and that's involving the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which you'll remember was the government agency designed to help bring increased consumer protection after the big banking crash. Chin expects that he's going to be needing to do a lot in the area of consumer protection, particularly in the financial arena.
And it would seem, especially in our state, with our sensitivity to what happens with the environment, that will also be one of the areas in which AGs may be banding together.
Absolutely true.
As you look out now over all of the issues that you've been seeing both in Washington and now here in Hawaii, Is there a sense of another coming wave that we have yet to talk about?
Well, I think the biggest next issue is going to be what happens with the budget, developing budget situation. President Trump would like to see a big increase in defense spending, which could in some ways be good for Hawaii, but unfortunately that would come at the cost of reductions in a number of other areas: education, health care, environmental regulation, consumer protection, some of the same areas that the Democratic AGs are already so worried about.
And clearly, with whatever is going to happen with health care, which is still pretty much a moving target, we don't know what may cause them to band together for that, too.
Unfortunately, that's true.
Okay. Well, we've got a lot to watch. Glad you're in D.C., and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Good to talk to you. Every day we speak with a Civil Beat reporter. Today we talk with Kirsten Downey for Reality Check. Over the next 4 years or so, there will be some changes coming to Honolulu's downtown and Chinatown. Projects based in the Complete Streets program will allow for multimodal transportation, giving pedestrians, bikes, and motor vehicles sections to travel safely and, if all goes as planned, a place to feel welcome. Tomorrow evening, the city is holding a community symposium and Complete Streets Expo to show off some of what they've learned so far from public and professional input. Mike Packard will be there. He's the first Complete Streets program administrator, and he's in our studio this morning with us. Hello.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Nice to talk to you today. We've talked about the Complete Streets program for quite a while and the idea that, you know, everybody should feel welcome if you're on a bike or if you're walking or if you're in your car. But some of the realities are just such that you have very small spaces when you look at Chinatown and when you look at parts of downtown where it just seems that these ways of getting around are thwarting each other. If you and I take a walk around downtown Chinatown area in 5 years, what's likely going to be the difference?
Well, realistically, when you look at Chinatown now, it's a very heavily walked community. Many of the people that live there don't own cars, and many of the businesses cater to them with the produce and many of the markets that are open for the frontage. With that desire to walk in the very heavily walked area, we look to be making it safer for pedestrians, and that's by extending the sidewalk at corners to shorten that crossing distance so pedestrians can get across in a shorter period without being as exposed to vehicles. In the downtown area, where we do have a little bit more roadway space, we are looking to bring in some protected bike facilities, notably on Bishop Street, and that allows us to make that connection from the Hotel Street and some of the other connections, like along the Civic Center Path and King Street, to bring people on bicycles into the downtown area in a safe environment off of the sidewalk.
Getting them to the downtown area safely has been an issue for a very, very long time, whether they're coming in from the east side and having to come maybe down Wailea Avenue and move into the Ala Moana area and then into downtown. There are pockets where it looks really good, but it's not all connected. So in having the Complete Streets in the urban core itself, how do you then look at getting people into the area so they can enjoy Complete Streets?
Yeah, that's a great point. And the reality is that this downtown Chinatown project is a small segment of a much larger program that we're getting underway with. And the mayor does have an intent over the next 4 years to build out that connected bicycle network that really provides a robust opportunity to make these connections throughout our urban core. And that's from Chinatown over to Diamond Head. And realistically, over the next couple of years, with bike share coming in the next few months and then rail and transit-oriented development, we have a changing Honolulu. And with that, we need to adapt to be able to cater to people and their desire to move around in things other than passenger vehicles.
Changing Honolulu in a lot of ways means that it may get a little more or a little less welcome in some fashion, as you know, we see a lot of construction happening or trying to just move about as all of this is underway. But after it's all over, will the Honolulu urban core and areas that's connected to it actually be more beautiful too? I'm thinking about areas around the country where they've had similar projects, and one of the big issues was make it pretty, make it a place where you want to go, which doesn't exactly fit a definition of downtown.
Yeah, you're absolutely true. Over the past, you know, couple of decades, we've largely built all our roads to accommodate vehicles, and in a vehicle passing by at 30, 40 miles an hour, you know, seeing trees is not as much of a necessity, and frankly, trees can be looked at as a maintenance issue, one that, you know, upends sidewalks and travel ways. But from a pedestrian and bicycle standpoint, when you're traveling at those slower speeds, that's when you can really appreciate the beauty that can come in a place like this. And in an area like Honolulu that has such great temperature and such ability, we really should be capitalizing on that and planting more things that can help treat our water better and deal with stormwater runoff much better. But as we activate these areas and make them more of an enjoyable place for people to be, you know, that will come with the businesses that cater to that and the changes that will come to make it a more of a beautiful place for people to be.
So those businesses will actually be responsible for that themselves or through a neighborhood association or for business associations? You're looking for them, as has happened in other areas, to be responsible for that. I'm thinking about Portland, for example.
Right. And we've seen examples from other cities, Portland, Seattle, as are two ideas where they've had the developers and the private entities be responsible for the frontage. Currently, we don't have those types of requirements set up everywhere. You know, we do have in Waikiki business improvement districts, and that's being looked at with the TOD program as well. The intent is that the city will do the best it can within our right-of-way, but we do need to look to the private industry and the partners there to do their fair share to help build upon the beauty of this place.
So how much dialogue has there been with those businesses in understanding that they're going to have to be a partner in this too?
Well, as it comes to TOD and the changes in those areas, that's definitely written into the need. And when we look at places like the downtown Chinatown area, we have reached out to many businesses. We've had dozens of meetings, met with hundreds of people about these changes coming in. But the reality of retrofitting existing roadways, it's not as much as TOD, which can be starting from the ground. You look at Kaka'ako and the development, which is pretty much sprouting up from an industrial area. You know, what we see in Kaka'ako later isn't going to be nothing to what it looks like now. They have the ability to really start from scratch. The majority of Oahu, especially in our urban core, we don't have that opportunity. So it's really going to be looking to retrofit as best we can.
So lest anyone, you know, have grand ideas about what this place is going to look like, it's not going to necessarily look like, you know, downtown Victoria and, you know, being able to walk along the front there. What's realistic for the urban core? What should we expect?
You know, and I don't think we should hold Honolulu up to these other cities, because the reality is we have different constraints than other cities may have. You know, as we noted, some of those other cities do have the funds that allow them to build these things and maintain them through private partnerships. However, the weather and the climate and the people that we have here in Honolulu, I really do think we have an amazing opportunity to change the way Honolulu looks and transform it from being such a car-centered urban core to being one more that is lively in our weekends and after work and throughout the day. So it's a place where people want to be. It's a place where people want to stay. And so therefore, that will adapt and change as the tide comes and as we move forward.
And clearly from the work that you're doing, it's a place where people's input is still very much welcome and important in developing those areas.
Absolutely. It's a big part of the Complete Streets program, having context-sensitive projects that we are looking for input. And the meeting that we're having tomorrow about the Downtown Chinatown project, we are still looking for input, and we're asking the community to come out and provide those comments either through email or cards or what have you, because this is a program that's here to serve the community, and that community is people who live, work, and play in these areas.
Well, thanks for coming in today. We'll be watching.
Thank you so much, Bethann.
Mike Packard is a licensed professional engineer and the City and County of Honolulu's first Complete Streets Program Administrator. His work includes traffic operations analysis and transportation's network planning of complete streets, bicycle and pedestrian facility design, and leveraging opportunities to adapt national and global best practices to Honolulu. The Community Symposium and Complete Streets Expo to show it off happens tomorrow night from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Laniakea YWCA on Richard Street.
Aloha, I'm Melina Lilios, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
And now our backyard quiz answer. Today we asked you to name a popular Garden Island beach that's also popular with the Hawaiian monk seal. This sandy spot on Kauai's south shore is a good place to observe them, but visitors are asked to keep their distance from protected species. The seals are present year-round, and volunteers are frequently on hand to educate tourists about their endangered status. There are fewer than 2,000 left, mostly, that's an estimate, but signs for future population growth are encouraging. Other creatures on view at today's answer are the honu, or green sea turtle, and the wedge-tailed shearwater. It's an especially good snorkeling spot where the rocky breakwater creatures, creates a space of clear water when an abundant reef fish population. Now, you may know that we are probably talking about Poipu Beach on Kauai.
And Beth Ann Laurie from Honolulu knew that, so she got it right. She'll be getting the prize. And that's today's quiz. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. It's all too easy to look at the ongoing struggles over America's borders and questions of who is allowed into the country and who is not as an abstraction. Few of us have been face to face with the human impact of building walls to keep people out. Richard Montoya, co-creator of the show Nogales, Storytellers in Cartel Country, is determined to take the issue away from the realm of abstraction, using a variety of media to tell the story of a teenage Mexican boy shot in the back by a U.S. Border Patrol officer. And Richard is on the phone with us now. Good morning, Richard. Thanks for talking with us.
Hello, Chris. Pleasure to be with you. As you said, Hawaiian Public Radio, boy, it just shot a wonderful little tingle through me, because it means a lot to be here right now at this critical time for our country. So thank you for having us.
Well, Richard, what happened to Jose Antonio Elena Rodriguez?
Well, he was a 15-year-old boy walking in his native Nogales, Mexico, which shares a border in immediacy with Nogales, Arizona. So Border Patrol agents can, U.S. Border Patrol agents can see into the Mexico side. And we're talking about a 30-foot iron metal fence slotted. And he was a great kid on the way to a basketball court with a backpack and to meet his younger brothers and sisters and to play some pickup ball after school. This particular corner was a pharmacy right there on the corner. Details are murky, but Border Patrol agents say that they had commanded him to stop from the U.S. side. And when he failed to stop or failed to understand, 12 to 13 rounds were fired through the metal slotted fence. And with at least 11 of the shots hitting the child and killing him instantly. And what ensues after that is, you know, a PR nightmare and a control spin from the U.S. Border Customs side, saying that, you know, it's a drug corridor, the agents were in fear for their life. And so as a flashpoint for us, for theater makers from the U.S., from San Francisco and Los Angeles, this event was just calling to us very strongly. So we flew down. We went to investigate as almost journalists from radio or television would do. It's a journalistic approach to theater, site-specific documentary theater, they're calling it. And we've been at this for about 15 years now. But this particular incident, given the height of the anti-immigration fervor in the U.S., really called out to us. So we went down to investigate and found what was a very normal kid, spoke to his grandmother in the home that he lived in. And then we also at the same time wanted to spend time with law enforcement. So we sat in the office of Phoenix, Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio, kind of the poster boy for zero tolerance for immigration.
Right.
And we spent several hours with Joe Arpaio to kind of get that side of law enforcement as well.
He how has the case been adjudicated? Has anyone been brought to trial? What has it?
Yes, a federal court has decided to hear the case. There's another case in El Paso. We'll see what happens in our current administration with all the U.S. attorneys being let go. But there's still circuit court judges all over America that are doing their job as on the judiciary. They are wanting to hear these cases, and so the Border Patrol agent who fired the rounds is facing a pretty massive trial. And this is what the family wanted. It was unprecedented because no other cases. People from Mexico hadn't been able to sue the Border Patrol. This is by far not the first and only incident. There's been a rash of them.
And yet, Richard, he was on Mexican soil.
He was. He was on Mexican soil. So that made the case very unusual.
Yeah.
And when you go down, Chris, and walk the area and spend as much time there that we did, it's 60 feet down. The Border Patrol agents are able to look down, bear down, point their rifles down. And so for a kid to, chuck a rock or claim that he was in a drug corridor area. Most of Mexico is a drug corridor. And what made it what gave it urgency also, Chris, was that the boy was killed 2 weeks after the Trayvon Martin acquittal in Florida. So this stand your ground, the rash of Black Lives Matter, something going on, in law enforcement. So the whole ball of wax was waiting for us to unpeel this onion, as theater makers.
And Richard, this is under the jurisdiction. We've heard about Sheriff Joe Arpaio in other contexts, right? This is in his area?
Well, no, it's not. But he's in Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
You travel about 100 miles south to Tucson. You either go into El Paso if you keep going east, or if you drop down south about another 45 miles, you go directly to Nogales on the U.S. side and then the border into Nogales, Mexico. So although it's not in his jurisdiction, to your question, Chris, it's a kind of a zeitgeist.
His sphere of influence
and of law enforcement and Border Patrol and ICE and what counters on the other side is a very active sanctuary movement that was born in Tucson. You've got human rights activists. You've got some wonderful law enforcement people on the other side in the Tucson area in Pima County that have also helped to lead this investigation. So it's not just Joe Arpaio who was voted out of office on this last term. You've got some more moderate law enforcement and politicians in the area that are, justice and seeking justice is still a it's a hard-fought battle, but by this going into the federal courts, we're inching closer to some sort of justice for the family. So that's good news.
But sheriffs are elected in Arizona.
They are.
So you could run on a law and order platform, a zero tolerance, stand your ground, all that stuff.
Yeah, when I sat with Sheriff Joe, who was an amiable, grandfatherly, 82-year-old guy, fought in Korea. My father fought in Korea.
Uh-huh.
He's a very Catholic man. My mom's very Catholic. I mean, this guy is a master at pushing sympathy buttons, and he's a master of media and charm. And so you sit with this sort of, you know, grandfatherly guy, and he plays My Way for you from his friend Frank Sinatra. Tommy Lasorda's on the wall. I mean, this. But when I sat with them, Chris, one of my first questions was, you are the son of Italian immigrants. And how do we square that with the idea of immigrants coming to the country to better themselves? And his response was, well, my parents came in legally through Ellis Island. And so the Rio Grande, as a kind of an illegal corridor, murky, and Ellis Island as a sort of hallowed ground, the legal way. So they tend to square up what we prosecute in the play as a moral question. It's a moral question for us, a question of Christian charity. The what's happening presently with the Steve Bannon Trump administration is in the East Los Angeles, where I live, Chris, a heavily Latino populated area and Asian area, has been the speed and swiftness and meanness of the ICE patrol agents, and mm-hmm. and the speed of which they've moved in to the neighborhoods, and they're not rounding up criminals. They're waiting at elementary school zones and asking parents for identification. So we've seen already where children are screaming and horrified, and it's and the ICE officers, they say police on the back. They don't say ICE. So this is a very calculated, and what Trump campaigned on and what it looks like on the streets of East Los Angeles is something akin to, you know, another country, another time, another place, you know.
Yeah, and it's history has shown what happens then, Richard.
Right. I you know, bite my tongue because I don't, you know, want to say the
well, I hear you.
The obvious, but it's to leave the hothouse of what's happening in East Los Angeles and Tucson and Arizona, and to have a chance to tell this story. You know, the subtitle is Storytellers in Cartel Country.
Yeah.
And it just feels like we're maybe in friendly ground here with Hawaii suing the administration for the travel ban. I mean, it just...
Let's hope so, Richard.
It's going to be really neat to kind of exercise and tell this story for our audience here on the island.
It'll be interesting to see what you bring back from being in the islands. Richard, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having us. Come out.
You bet.
See the show if you can.
Richard Montoya is the co-founder of the San Francisco-based Chicano performance group Culture Clash and the co-creator with Sean San Jose and Juan Osato of Nogales, Storytellers in Cartel Country. It'll be performed Thursday evening at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center's McCoy Studio Theater. We like to keep ourselves and our listeners in touch with activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on that are under the radar. How are you doing?
Good.
All right.
Very good, Chris.
We're seeing more activity every year from women in Hawaii, women in filmmaking.
Yes, yes. And the director of a documentary about the Sandy Hook school shooting will talk about her film. Her name is Kim A. Snyder, and she'll discuss how the camera can be used to deal with highly sensitive topics.
Sounds a bit like the conversation we just had, and that's a free class, yeah?
Yes, yes. It's an interactive class as well, and it'll explore ethical issues and how film can provide a path toward healing communities. The film that she directed was Newtown, and the class is free tomorrow from 6 to 8 p.m. at Women, Hawaii Women in Filmmaking. That's at 3167 Wailea Avenue.
And so continuing with the theme of storytelling, we're over on the Big Island.
Yes, yes. On the Big Island, if you have some stories to tell, there are some children willing to listen. Between now and the end of April, La Pahoehoe Public Library and the fourth grade class of La Pahoehoe Public Charter School are collecting oral histories of the Hamakua Coast. And students will be interviewing community members with a goal of publishing a book called Mo'olelo o Hamakua, Stories of Homokua, and they're interested in historical anecdotes, stories about the old sugar days, you know, the plantations, World War II, legends, and even ghost stories. Well,
there's plenty of those in that part of Hawaii Island, aren't there?
For more information on this project, all you have to do is contact the Laupahoehoe Library, and the phone number is on our website.
And continuing on the Big Island, we've got hula.
Yes, a free hula performance at Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. Hala will be dancing tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. on the Kilauea Visitor Center Lanai. And this is all part of Hawaii Volcanoes' ongoing Na Leo Manu Heavenly Voices presentations.
Hula in an ideal setting, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's perfect.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
Oh, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. And you can always find out more about said events at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Beth Ann, you would think with all that we've learned about cigarette smoking in the course of our lifetimes that the industry would perhaps be a little less aggressive in marketing to children.
But why should they, really?
I guess, if there's money to be made.
And the fact that we see so many people engage with e-cigarettes now, even coming out of our building where there will be people there, and they're doing it because they enjoy it and they want to do that. And in some cases may not understand that that, too, poses some health risks.
There's a perception that e-cigarettes are safer. Is that an accurate one?
According to those who don't like them, no. And there have been some other studies that they point to saying that it can be just as dangerous for people. Certainly if you have conditions, asthma, other conditions, too, and you just walk by that, it could trigger an attack.
Well, given that nicotine is an acknowledged poison and that these are a nicotine delivery systems, you can kind of put two and two together, I would think.
And when they come in, lovely flavors like cotton candy and gummy bear, and they kind of have the veil of candy and goodness over them.
Yeah.
It makes it tough to say that they are not so good for you. But that's exactly what the tobacco advocates are saying.
Looks pretty shameless.
Yeah, tobacco
from here.
Advocates, I should say.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see what happens with the bills that are still alive and if, in fact, some of that tax ends up going to the Master Tobacco Settlement Fund.
Wow.
That's going to do it for us for the moment. We will be back with you tomorrow with social activist and author Ai-Jen Poo looking to help those who care for Hawaii's elderly.
And there's a free figure drawing class on Maui.
You can get to us anytime you like at 808-792-8217 and leave us your comments or post them on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Or you can send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Past shows are archived under The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you tomorrow with more of The Conversation.